The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On Monday, September 16th, the Ministry of Health of Spain, the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Europe, and the European Observatory on Health Systems and Policies held a spotlight session on addressing youth alcohol prevention in order to provide a broader regional perspective on alcohol prevention among young people and particularly minors in Europe, with recent evidence on prevention and best policy practices. On today's show, we're going to hear some highlights. Dr. Pablo Estrella Porter is a medical doctor from Ecuador. He holds a master's in public health from Spain's National School of Public Health and is currently working toward his doctorate in that field. He's currently pursuing a public health and preventive medicine residency in Valencia, and he's also a member of the EVID Action Early Career Research Network. Very quickly, I should explain that EVID Action is short for the Evidence into Action Alcohol Project, which was launched by WHO's Regional Office for Europe in order to bring scientific evidence to promote and support the implementation of effective alcohol policies. Here's Dr. Porter.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. I'm coming to talk about the approach to prevention throughout the life cycle. What are the next steps following the draft bill? When we talk about lifelong prevention, we need to take into account different factors that will have varying degrees of impact depending on the life stage. These things change over time, and this is closely linked to the needs and the risks to which we have exposure at different ages. As we've said earlier, this is key when we talk about alcohol prevention. We need to talk about the social determinants of health and commercial determinants of health. Now, this type of approach is clearly beneficial. If we are considering an intervention over a life cycle, we should first focus on early interventions. As we've seen in other presentations, they will have impact not only on young adults, but also on society at large. Other benefits are adapting to specific ages and considering changes to public policy. This holistic approach portrays individual as a person who takes a decision to consume or not, but also interacts with other factors linked to consumption. Now, if you focus on adolescence, it is a key stage when these consumption patterns develop. And that is why we're working on this draft law, and it's going to have long-term impact. I want to share a positive example of something that has been done with these ages. The Sober Curious, a young person who actively decides, without identifying himself as sober, decides not to use alcohol and drink non-alcoholic drink. They do this based on a healthy lifestyle choice, and they've seen this with the Z generation. This is a positive impact that we might not have noticed in prior generations. And in our own experience, we can also see how these patterns change. Another important population are pregnant women. When we talk about pregnancy, we need to talk about prevention and exposure during different stages. This means that when women are in a fertile age and during pregnancy, we can have a clear impact on the environment. This means we could talk with their partners and with their close environment to prevent exposure to alcohol. And of course, during pregnancy, this is fairly evident, but during breastfeeding as well. Now, this is another example I wanted to touch upon in connection to that. The Ministry of Health is actually working on this. It's a group working on the prevention of alcohol consumption. Now, this group is working on screening and brief interventions during pregnancies. Now, it's key to work on these with local experts in regional communities and scientific communities. And I am honored to be part of this, representing the scientific community. This document will be presented shortly, and it tries to act on the evidence. And this is the framework on which we've been working on through Eviduction. We need to use these lenses. Evidence really needs to drive decision making. And how does this happen? Now, let's talk about the multidisciplinary approach and how it applies to the youth. We've looked at the social determinants of health. We know that they are key in terms of how much in alcohol and how the alcohol will be used. When we talk about family, social environment, well, however much alcohol your parents and use alcohol and social meetings, this has impact on you. What happens when leisure is always linked to alcohol? And also the urban setting. This draft bill also touches upon how close a center that sells alcohol is to a school. How can we make cities more user-friendly? How can they offer entertainment or leisure options that do not include alcohol? When you look at our anthropological reasons, this is inherent to our culture. Things can change, but as Maria mentioned earlier, younger generations might not be drinking as much. Binge drinking is also changing patterns, and this is definitely something we need to take into account beyond other determinants of health. Now, let me touch upon another concept, the commercial determinants of health. Now, this evidences that the industry and the way we manage the industry will have a clear impact on alcohol consumption. When we talk about communications and marketing, we've seen some examples already. It's important to highlight that how information is used and what are the sources changes over time. The younger generations are showing changes in their patterns. Older generations using the internet or traditional using the internet and social media, but younger people use social media as the first source of information. There is no clear regulation about that. Or let's say the industry is advertising 00 type of drinks that might still have a percentage of alcohol. Now, this type of marketing is very similar to the one they use for alcoholic drinks. And then the pricing, as it has been mentioned already, and availability. What is the point of selling, making them more expensive if we don't have a minimum price? The labeling and packaging are also key. We've seen this on Tobacco, and that lesson is very clear. The labeling is clear, but there's a lot of opposition to this in alcohol because the industry wants to approach younger population through labeling and packaging. They want packaging to seem healthier, or they want it to be harder to differentiate between energy drinks and sodas. And there are other commercial determinants of health. Now, there's a point important for in both cases, which is health inequalities. We know this, and these determinants have different degrees of impact on different populations. So when we try on determinants and we talk about public health, we're not just talking about the population at large. There will be certain populations that will be more heavily affected by determinants. Now, let's move on to policy and incidence and evidence. This is a slide from Elena that I added to my deck. The 2024 WHO work plan includes these measures, which have clear impact on alcohol use, pricing, I don't want to make that point again, but the minimum unit pricing is key. Availability, we've mentioned this already. Where can people buy alcohol? How close those locations or shops are from their place of work or their place of study? And third, information with a focus on alcohol labeling, marketing, which is key. We've talked about this. And number fifth is the response from health services. This is key, and we see that the ministry is working on this. With this brief intervention and the screening, this is being proposed to adults and risk populations, such as pregnant women. And then community action, not just education, and there might be less evidence on this, but also integrating these policies and making them more acceptable and making sure that the different communities that are affected feel that they own them. Finally, what are the keys I want to offer? Being a young doctor, offering a young perspective, what can we do with this new draft bill? First, we need to change the risk perception. Alcohol is perceived as a low-risk product. We need to change that around, and we need data for that. Well, accidental and unintentional injuries related to alcohol are one key point. Also, risk factors increase around sexually transmitted infections by the use of alcohol, and the risk factor for chronic illnesses such as cancer. This might not be so clear among the youth, but if you look at the incidence of other massive use products such as tobacco, there has been a paradigm shift in the risk perception when we've included this. And then addressing social and commercial determinants of health in health policies, as we've seen in previous presentations, this needs to follow the health in all policies premise. What I'm trying to say here is that when we talk about, well, the different alignments going forward, we always think they're going to have an impact on health. When we're working on accessibility to a park, this is going to have impact not only on urban policies, but alternative leisure activities. And then an emphasis on prevention from a very early age. The risk factor needs to be reduced. And we also need to see everything through the lenses of evidence. We see that, well, evidence can then drive public health policy. And with the lower amount of resources, this helps us get maximum impact. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Pablo Estrella Porter. He's currently pursuing a public health and preventive medicine residency in Valencia and is also a member of the EVID Action Early Career Research Network. He was speaking September 16th at a session entitled Addressing Youth Alcohol Prevention, which was organized by the Ministry of Health of Spain, the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Europe, and the European Observatory on Health Systems and Policies. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Maria Neufeld is a technical officer in the Alcohol, Illicit Drugs, and Prison Health Program at the World Health Organization's regional office in Europe.
So, when we look at alcohol, it is a leading risk factor for premature death and mortality in young people. Here are the latest data from the Global Burden of Disease study for the European Union. And so here you see that on the left side, you see alcohol being really the top risk factor in the younger age group, whereas when we look at all ages, alcohol ranks pretty much in the middle, and it has something to do with the causes of death that for which alcohol is responsible, to which alcohol contributes. And it's really mostly injuries in this case, which already is one of the answers to the question, why is alcohol so dangerous for young people? Next slide. And there, yeah, just, yes, and one more. Yes. Okay. So, and it's basically, as Dr. Vijabi was saying, it's an interaction of different things. So we have the biological, we have the behavior, we have the environmental factors. So things like, you know, yes, human brains are actually very, very complex, much more complex than we initially thought, and they take much more time to mature than we initially thought. So actually, you know, like recent studies, they show like that brains do not mature up until the age of 25. And the last thing that actually matures in your brain is your prefrontal cortex, you know, like the prefrontal lobes that are responsible for things like impulse control and you know, like reckless behavior, that kind of thing. I mean, the fact that young people, they have a lower body mass, the fact that alcohol is a neurotoxin, the fact that young people as such are more prone to risk-taking behavior, so, you know, and alcohol having a disinhibiting effect on that, like it all plays together, and of course the environments also play a huge role. So young people are much more, let's say, sensitive to like stress or instability in those things like family and school environments, peers, and then things like access to alcohol, advertising, peer pressure, they all play a role. And it all contributes to this vulnerability. And that's why we also have this overproportional harm due to alcohol in the form of alcohol poisoning. So in fact, it's actually very easy to poison yourself with alcohol as compared to other substances. We have lots of death being caused by injury or drownings or falls, violence, self-harm, suicide. We've been talking a bit about the issue of mental health earlier. This really plays a huge role here. Next slide. So this is just to look at the latest data that we have for our region from 2019, and it really shows you how alcohol-attributable death, so all the deaths that are caused by alcohol that would not have occurred without alcohol otherwise, how they are distributed over the life course. And what you see here is a clear peak at the ages of like 20s or 30s. So basically this slide shows you that compared to other risk factors, alcohol basically kills very early in life. It kills at a point in time when, you know, like when young adults are supposed to enter the market to be productive, to form families of their own and so forth. So here we see that, for example, it's estimated that every fourth person in our region dies at a young age because of alcohol. Next. And that's why it's such a good idea to have a minimum age for alcohol, and it's such a good idea to enforce it. And here, just next, like to the end of the slide here, I'm just going to present, I was very fascinated by the study that came out last year in The Lancet, and it shows, it is an analysis of real world data from Finland, because in Finland in 1969, they have decreased their minimum age from 21 to 18. So this thing really happened, and researchers looked at like which impact did it have. And the interesting thing was, because this came out overnight, I mean, it affected most of the alcohol, not the very light beverages. But when it came out overnight, four different cohorts of people had access to alcohol. When you were 18, 19, 20, or 21, you could buy alcohol. So what the researchers did, they just looked, okay, what has happened to those people decades later, like now? And they found out that those who had access to alcohol earlier at 18 years old, they had higher risk of dying of something related to alcohol, attributed to alcohol, than those who had to wait a bit longer to get access to the alcohol. So basically the study concludes, if you have a minimum age that is high, the higher the better actually, it has a very protective effect that extends far beyond young adulthood. And I don't know, looking at my teenager years, I wish I would have known these things earlier. Next slide, please. The good news though is that, well, actually younger people in most countries, not in all, but younger people are drinking less than previous generations. So young people today, they're drinking less than their parents, drinking less than their grandparents. Here's a book on that. The interesting thing is that We actually don't know why this is the case, because it's a very complex phenomenon. There are different explanations why this could be the case, you know, like immigration from non-drinking cultures, changing norms, you know, actually better protection services, better child well-being, better regulation. But it's very complex, and you know, like research on that there is happening. So I just put some resources here, and if you want to hear more about that, we also had a small podcast on that from our program, because I also believe it's really important how we frame the issue, because like oftentimes younger people are presented as the problematic drinkers. Yes, they're more vulnerable, but actually the problematic drinkers are the adults, or specifically the older adults. Next slide, please. So now let's talk about alcogenic environments. As I was saying, this is a very important concept that really points out to the power of the structural things, like the settings in which we live, in which we work, how they're structured. And out of that, we can also go to the interventions that work to reduce alcohol consumption. Next slide. So alcogenic environments are basically settings or conditions that facilitate, encourage, and normalize alcohol consumption. And unfortunately, you know, like in Europe, when you look at Europe as a whole, we have lots of alcogenic environments. You know, like those are environments where alcohol is too cheap, too available, too heavily promoted. It's basically everywhere. And it's also what makes it very difficult for people to recognize and admit that, you know, like I might be drinking too much, or, you know, like I might be already suffering from alcohol-related, you know, like harm, or, you know, someone in my environment and so forth, because it is the stigma. Because alcohol, it is so normalized that it's stigmatized to say if once you have a problem. Like, everyone drinks like normal, but the moment you admit that I might have an alcohol use disorder, it's very difficult, you're stigmatized, and this is changing, but in many countries there is still, you know, you might still receive lots of judgment, not really find the care, the support that you need, and this is because of, again, how we perceive, how we think, how we talk about alcohol, because those the environments, they personalize the problem, they make you yourself responsible for that instead of, you know, basically addressing the structural factors that are driving the consumption, such as marketing, for example. Next slide, please. So that's why the most effective interventions to reduce alcohol consumption and to reduce consumption of harm are basically those that are challenging those environments. Those are structural things, and we call them in the WHO the best buys, because like they're the cost-effective interventions, meaning that for you get the most out, the most result out of the least resources invested. And for alcohol, those are increasing taxes, restricting availability, minimum drinking age, for example, or restricting places of sales and so forth, restricting bans of marketing. Those interventions are very cheap compared to others, such as, for example, providing, you know, treating people, because treating people is always very costly. And things like increasing tax, you actually get money out of that. So next one. Yeah. And this, I will not go here I will not go too much into detail. I just want to point out that within those three things, the things that work really well for the general population, for all ages, but that actually work even better for young people. So for example, when we're talking about taxation, again, I'm really happy that, you know, that you're thinking about that and also collaborating with the Ministry of Finance, because I mean, it is a win-win, right? It should be a no-brainer in a way. What really works is increasing, for example, taxes on things that are on products that are targeting young people specifically. So for example, Alkopop. So I was, for example, part of a generation growing up in Germany where Alkopops at some point were so popular, everyone was drinking them because you could buy them already at 16. But then Germany has increased specifically taxes on Alkopops, and Germany has specifically also increased the minimum drinking age. And overnight, Alkopops were no longer cool anymore, because just like no one could afford them anymore. It was, you know, cheaper to drink something else. Another consideration that also works quite well is, for example, introducing a minimum price below which a certain product cannot be bought. And again, because young people are usually on a strict budget, it works quite well. About limiting availability, I already showed the minimum drinking age. We'll hear more about it from Yelena. Here, the issue is like you really need to enforce it well so that it works. Restricting sale hours is also very important. It works very well for young people at night, for example, where you have lots of intoxication, lots of violence. And banning or restricting alcohol marketing. I mean, here, like, we have far less empirical data as, for example, intoxication, but we have really good lessons to be learned from tobacco, for example, because we know that marketing, I mean, it really works. Industry is putting millions, billions behind it because it really works. It attracts new drinkers, so young people. And it's a very effective strategy. Next one. What is also important are effective drink driving policies for young people. That I'm really happy that that there was a change in the minimum blood concentration level, because as you can imagine, the moment where you have being legally able to drink and getting your driver's license and then reckless behavior and that kind of thing. So it's quite a mix. So that's why it's really important to have really good policies, very low blood alcohol levels, zero tolerance for young and novice drivers, and then things like random sobriety checks and strict penalties. So enforcement is really key. And actually, what doesn't work or doesn't really work or works, but only in combination with other things, and it's really complicated, it's the area of education. I'm not saying that education is not important, but I'm saying that education can only work when you do all the other things. Education provides you knowledge about alcohol and the risks, but it will not necessarily change your behavior as much. When you're in an alcoholic environment, you have the knowledge, but then alcohol is everywhere. It's cheap, it's affordable, it's promoted. So will you really remember the school lesson? Evidence shows no.
That was Maria Neufeld, Technical Officer in the Alcohol, Illicit Drugs, and Prison Health Program at the World Health Organization's Regional Office in Europe, speaking September 16th at a session entitled Addressing Youth Alcohol Prevention that was organized by the Ministry of Health of Spain, the World Health Organization's Regional Office for Europe, and the European Observatory on Health Systems and Policies. I particularly like the approach taken by many European nations and by the WHO in regard to substances, because among other things, they understand that alcohol and tobacco are drugs. ATOD, alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs. Here in the US, we frequently hear officials and even a lot of researchers who frankly know better talking about drugs and alcohol as if they're different things. It's frustrating and it's just plain stupid. It's denial. I have a similar objection to people saying they're drinkers when what they mean is they use alcohol. I mean, what? You're alive, so of course you consume liquids like water, tea, other non-alcoholic beverages are available, of course. I mean, just be honest about it. For example, I would say that September 25th, 2024 marks 3 years since I stopped using alcohol. Do I still drink? I have a cup of tea next to me. It's a lovely Earl Grey. I'm not going to snort it for crying out loud. Of course I'm going to drink it. The point is, ditch the euphemisms. Denial ain't pretty. And on that note, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Century of Lies is a volunteer production for Community Radio, syndicated via the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network's audio port service. Please support your local community radio station. Become a member. Become a volunteer. You can find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. You'll find a link there to subscribe to the Century of Lies podcast. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.